Beyond presents Spoilers for The Tragedy of Antony by Robert Garnier, translated by Mary Sidney. Continuing our journey through the play from midway through Act 2, the scene featuring the first appearance of Cleopatra. Following are some introductory notes and a plain text recording of the dialogue, plain text being the first cut edit of our full cast audio adaptation. It has all the text, but no SFX, no Foley, and it's the edit we use to hunt out textual errors, retakes, or cuts, so it's not perfect, and we may change the take for the final thing. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the episode further up the podcast list. Seriously, this is an exercise that some listeners won't enjoy. If it ain't for you, move on. If you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land.
Spoiler land.
Never ends, does it? Before I start, this is a play with themes of suicide throughout. The entire play is basically a meditation on how to end your life at the end of a really, really terrible series of events. The characters, of course, have pretty good reasons why they might want to take their own lives, because somebody else would take it for them or dishonour them in various ways. So they don't have a huge amount of agency here, but obviously that may be triggering for some people, so just be warned. It is also a play set during war, so death and destruction are part of the mix. So now that we're out of the opening gambits of speech after speech in Act 1 going into Act 2, here we get to a scene with some pucker dynamics. On stage, we open with Cleopatra and servants Eris and Charmion. Diomed is listed as on, but they don't say anything for ages, so might as well not be. Following Antony's blame game finger-pointing at Cleopatra, Cleo picks up the baton with some self-flagellation too, where on the other side of the Battle of Actium, things have not gone well.
That I have thee betrayed, dear Antony. My life, my soul, my son. I had such thought. That I have thee betrayed, my lord, my king. That I would break my vowed faith to thee, leave thee, deceive thee, yield thee to the rage of mighty foe. I ever had that heart. Rather sharp lightning lighten on my head. Rather may I to deepest mischief fall. Rather the opened earth devour me. Rather fierce tigers feed them on my flesh. Rather, oh, rather let Arnila send to swallow me quick some weeping crocodile.
There's something slightly slippery about this lament. Is Cleopatra lamenting that he believes that she has betrayed him? Or that she did betray him, but not with any intent? It's an interesting opening gambit for the character. Could you really have believed I would do this to you? And considering what she has lost, which is the greater loss, Antony or her kingdom?
And didst thou then suppose my royal heart had hatched thee to ensnare a faithless love? And changing mind as fortune changed cheer, I would weak thee to win the stronger lose. O wretch, O caitiff, O too cruel hap! And did not I sufficient loss sustain, losing my realm, losing my liberty, my tender offspring, and the joyful light of beamy sun? And yet losing more, thee, Antony, my care, if I lose not what yet remained. Thy love, alas, thy love more dear than sceptre, children, freedom, light.
And now we head back to the theme of the death wish, which will be a prompt that her servants leap in on.
So ready I to row in Charon's barge, shall lease the joy of dying in thy love. So the sole comfort of my misery to have one tomb with thee is me bereft. So I in shady plains shall plain alone, not as I hoped, companion of thy moan, O height of grief!
So with relative economy, Cleopatra has got the grief ball rolling. Eris, however, has had enough. This lamenting isn't healthy. Show some backbone.
Why, with continual cries, your griefful harms do you exasperate?
Torment yourself with murdering complaints. Strain your weak breast so oft, so vehemently. Water with tears this fair alabaster. With sorrow sting so many beauties wound.
Surely as a royal person, and we should note throughout this text that Cleopatra and many of the figures here are coded as white. It is an element that comes from Robert Garnier's version and also is part of the narrative of Cleopatra and her Ptolemaic descent. We're not going to be engaging in this question in this particular version. It is something that we will be returning to when we return to this text in different variations further down the line. So Cleopatra is constantly going to be referred to in this text as being a fair alabaster, or in fact in the original spelling, alablaster. Surely, as a royal person, you can cope with this stuff better than this.
Come, of so many kings, want you the heart bravely, stoutly this tempest to resist?
My evils are wholly unsupportable. No human force can them withstand but death.
Oh, to him that strives, naught is impossible.
In striving lies no hope of my mishaps.
All things do yield to force of lovely face.
And again, we're into the beauty of Cleopatra, again racially coded here. Her beauty isn't a way out of this mess, as it helped us get into it. Listeners to the last episode will recognise the traditional view of the Battle of Actium expressed here. It was following Cleopatra because of love that lost the battle.
My face, too lovely, caused my wretched case. My face hath so entrapped, so cast us down, that for his conquest Caesar may it thank, causing that Antony one army lost, the other wholly did to Caesar yield. For not enduring so his amorous sprite was with my beauty fired, my shameful flight. Soon as he saw from rank wherein he stood in hottest fight, my galleys making sail, forgetful of his charge, as if his soul unto his lady's soul had been enchained, he left his men, who so courageously did leave their lives to gain him victory, and careless both of fame and army's loss, my oared galleys followed with his ships, companion of my flight, by this base part blasting his former flourishing renown.
Eris asks the question, perhaps dubious of the historicity of this account of the battle, whether that's really what went down.
Are you therefore cause of his overthrow?
I am sole cause. I did it, only I.
Fear of a woman troubled so his sprite.
Fire of his love was by my fear inflamed.
Eris changes tack. If Antony was prone to such a reaction, why did you let him lead you to war? Cleopatra takes that on herself too.
And should he then to war have led a queen?
Alas, this was not his offence but mine. Antony, ay me, who else so brave a chief? Would not I should have taken seas with him, but would have left me, fearful woman, far from common hazard of the doubtful war. Oh, that I had believed! Now of Rome all the great empire at our beck should bend. All should obey. The vagabonding scythes, the feared Germans, backshooting Parthians, wandering Numidians, Britons far removed, and tawny nations scorched with the sun. But I cared not. So was my soul possessed to my great harm with burning jealousy, fearing lest in my absence Antony should leaving me retake Octavia.
Eris has run out of steam, so Charmian has go. Look, it's not you. It's destiny and the gods. Even queens can't beat the gods. Cleopatra is having none of that.
Such was the rigour of your destiny.
Such was my error and obstinacy.
But since gods would not, could you do with all?
Always from God's good haps, not harms, do fall.
And have they not all power on men's affairs?
They never bow so low as worldly cares, but leave to mortal men to be disposed freely on earth whatever mortal is. If we therein sometimes some faults commit, we may them not to their high majesties, but to ourselves impute, whose passions plunge us each day in all afflictions. Wherewith, when we our souls do thorned feel, flattering ourselves, we say they destinies are, that gods would have it so, that our care could not impeach, but that it must be so.
Which is a reasonable enough point, but Charmian is going to keep on prodding that the gods are messing with us line.
Things here below are in the heavens begot before they be in this our world born. And never can our weakness turn awry the sailless course of powerful destiny. Naught here, force, reason, human providence, holy devotion, noble blood, prevails. And Jove himself, whose hand doth heavens rule, who both to gods and men as king commands, who earth, our firm support, with plenty stores, moves air and sea with twinkling of his eye, who all can do, yet never can undo what once hath been by their hard laws decreed.
Having set up her thesis, now for examples of the gods' general shittiness when it comes to fortune.
When Trojan walls, great Neptune's workmanship, environed were with Greeks, and fortune's wheel, doubtful 10 years, now to the camp did turn, and now again towards the town returned. How many times did force and fury swell in Hector's veins, egging him to the spoil of conquered foes, which at his blows did fly as fearful sheep at feared wolves' approach, to save, in vain, for why, it would not be, poor walls of Troy from adversaries' rage, who dyed them in blood and cast to ground, heaped them with bloody burning carcasses.
So, Queen, if the gods willed it, it is done. But we must endure it. Classical stoicism is clearly Charmian's bag.
No, madam. Think that if the ancient crown of your progenitors that Nihilus ruled force take from you, the gods have willed it so, to whom oft-times princes are odious. They have to everything an end ordained. All worldly greatness by them bounded is, some sooner, later some, as they think best. None their decree is able to infringe. But, which is more, to us disastered men, which subject are in all things to their will is hid. Nor while we live, we know how or how long we must in life remain. Yet must we not for that feed on despair? And make us wretched ere we wretched be, but always hope the best, even to the last, that from ourselves the mischief may not grow.
And in conclusion, if you want to survive this, you must betray Antony. Side with Caesar, bat your eyelashes, and you might just get away with it.
Then, madam, help yourself. Leave off in time Antony's rack, lest it your rack procure. Retire you from him, save from wrathful rage of angry Caesar both your realm and you. You see him lost, so as your amity unto his evils can yield no more relief. You see him ruined, so as your support no more henceforth can him with comfort raise. Withdraw you from the storm! Persist not still to lose yourself, this royal diadem, regain of Caesar.
Not the most progressive of feminist anthems, but this is a crisis. Cleopatra, it's a no from her. Team Antony, all the way.
Sooner shining light shall leave the day and darkness leave the night. Sooner moist currents of tempestuous seas shall wave in heaven, and the nightly troops of stars shall shine within the foaming waves, than I thee, Antony, leave in deep distress. I am with thee. Be it thy worthy soul lodge in thy breast, or from that lodging part crossing the joyless lake to take her place, in place prepared for men or demigods. Live, if thee please. If life be loathsome, die. Dead and alive, Antony, thou shalt see thy princess follow thee. Follow and lament thy rack no less her own than was thy weal.
Charmian has another go. What's the use of all this love stuff?
What helps his rack this everlasting love?
Help or help not, such ought I prove.
Ill done to lose yourself and to no end.
How ill think you to follow such a friend?
But this your love not mitigates his pain.
Without this love I should be inhumane.
Inhumane he, who his own death pursues.
Not inhumane whom misery eschews.
Charmian tries to appeal to the lives of her sons, and Cleopatra remains focused entirely on Antony.
Live for your sons!
Nay, for their father die.
Hard-hearted mother.
Wife kind-hearted I.
Then will you them deprive of royal right?
Do I deprive them? No, it's destiny's might.
Which I think contradicts Cleopatra's earlier argument, but hey, she's under a lot of stress. Charmian argues that blood is thicker than water here. Cleopatra counters that to abandon a friend would be the worse sin.
Do you not them deprive of heritage, that give them up to adversaries' hands, a man forsaken, fearing to forsake, whom such huge numbers hold environed? To abandon one against whom the frowning world, banded with Caesar, makes conspiring war.
The less ought I to leave him least of all. A friend in most distress should most assist. If that when Antony, great and glorious, his legions led to drink Euphrates' streams, so many kings in train redoubting him, in triumph raised as high as highest heaven, lordlike disposing as him pleased best, the wealth of Greece, the wealth of Asia, in that fair fortune had I him exchanged for Caesar, then men would have counted me faithless, unconstant, light. But now the storm and blustering tempest driving on his face ready to drown. Alas! What would they say? What would himself in Pluto's mansion say, if I, whom always more than life he loved, if I, who am his heart, who was his hope, leave him, forsake him, and perhaps in vain, weakly to please who him hath overthrown. Not liked, unconstant, faithless should I be, but vile, forsworn of treacherous cruelty.
It's a point of view, and one of those classical honour questions, I suppose. But it's clearly more than that. The Cleopatra of this text is utterly obsessed with Antony. There is no pulling back from him. And that really makes what Antony says in Act 1 really unfair. This Cleopatra would never betray him. This really is an obsessive love affair from her point of view. How dare he think that would happen? And finally, if you won't think of your children, think of yourself.
Cruelty to shun, you self-cruel are.
Self-cruel him from cruelty to spare.
Our first affection to ourself is due.
He is myself.
Okay, ego subsumed to the love interest, we get it. But you're also bringing everyone else down with you. The court, the populace of Alexandria, me.
Next it extends unto our children, friends, and to our country soil. And you, for some respect of wifely love, albeit scarce wifely, lose your native land, your children, friends, and which is more, your life. With so strong charms doth love bewitch our wits, so fast in us this fire once kindled flames. Yet if his harm by yours redress might have,
with mine it may be closed in darksome grave.
Cleopatra's interjections are irrelevant now. Charmian is on a roll. He's dead, madam. There is no saving him. Move on.
And that, as Alceste to herself unkind, you might exempt him from the laws of death. But he is sure to die. And now his sword, already moisted, is in his warm blood, helpless for any succour you can bring against death's sting, which he must shortly feel.
The best you can do for him is to live and build him a lovely tomb like that for Morsellus. Hold a festival in his memory. Let his children live.
Then let your love be like the love of old, which Carian Queen did nourish in her heart of her Morsellus. build for him a tomb whose stateliness a wonder new may make. Let him have sumptuous funerals. Let grave thereon the horror of his fights. Let earth be buried with unburied heaps. Frame the farcely and discoloured streams of deep Enipeus. Frame the grassy plain which lodged his camp at siege of Mutina. Make all his combats and courageous acts and yearly plays to his praise institute. Honour his memory. With doubled care, breed and bring up the children of you both in Caesar's grace, who as a noble prince will leave them lords of this most glorious realm.
We await to see if Cleopatra is going with it. Waiting. No, computer says no. It would be shaming to live on beyond him.
What shame were that? Ah, gods, what infamy! With Antony and his good haps to share, and o'erlive him dead, deeming enough to shed some tears upon a widow tomb. The afterlivers justly might report that I him only for his empire loved, and high estate, and that in hard estate I for another did him lewdly leave. Like to those birds wafted with wandering wings, from foreign lands in springtime here arrive, and live with us so long as summer's heat and their food lasts, then seek another soil. And, as we see with ceaseless fluttering flocking of sealy flies, a brownish cloud to vintaged wine yet working in the tun, not parting thence while they sweet liquor taste, after, as smoke, all vanish in the air, and of the swarm not one so much appear.
Charmian is out. Nothing left in the tank. Eris has another go. What do you get out of being dead? Praise, duty, virtue, what do you get?
By this sharp death, what profit can you win?
I neither gain nor profit seek therein.
What praise shall you of after ages get?
Nor praise nor glory in my cares are set.
What other end ought you respect than this?
My only end, my only duty is.
Your duty must upon some good be founded.
On virtue it, the only good, is grounded.
What is that virtue?
That which us beseems.
Outrage ourselves, who that beseeming deems.
Finish I will my sorrows, dying thus.
Minish you will your glories doing thus.
It's such a waste. Cleopatra now takes some control of the conversation. Right, stop it. Decision made, I'm going to die. But you are going to go on and honour our memory, okay?
Good friends, I pray you seek not to revoke my fixed intent of following Antony. I will die. I will die. Must not his life and death, by mine be followed? Meanwhile, dear sisters, live, and while you live, do often honour to our loved tombs. Strew them with flowers, and sometimes, haply, the tender thought of Antony, your lord, and me, poor soul, to tears shall you invite, and our true loves your doleful voice commend.
And this is the moment that really unlocks this scene for me. Okay, look, Cleopatra is a bit much. She's locked in some very dodgy history and sexual politics. But having said all the above, and said to her servants to go on without her, Charmian comes back with this.
And think you, madam, we from you will part? Think you alone to feel death's ugly dart? Think you to leave us? And that the same sun shall see at once you dead and us alive? We'll die with you. And Clotho pitiless shall us with you in hellish boat embark.
You think we are going to abandon you? Ooh, never going to happen. And that pushes Cleopatra towards something perhaps more real. Because this isn't just about some mythic love affair or the gods. Her servants, her closest confidants, will die with her. And now, Conversely, Cleopatra has to try and argue them into life.
Ah, Liv, I pray you. This disastered woe which racks my heart alone to me belongs. My lot longs not to you. Servants to be no shame, no harm to you as is to me.
And Cleopatra sidesteps the thought of their living. Back to Antony, bringing in Diomed to tell Antony that she has already killed herself. This is a perfectly reasonable plan that will not go badly wrong.
Live, sisters, live! And seeing his suspect hath causeless me in sea of sorrows drowned, and that I cannot live, if so I would, nor yet would leave this life, if so I could, without his love. Procure me, Diomed, that against poor me he be no more incensed. Wrest out of his conceit that harmful doubt that since his wrack he hath of me conceived, though wrong conceived, witness you reverent gods, barking, Anubis, Apis, bellowing. Tell him, my soul burning, impatient, forlorn with love of him, for certain seal of her true loyalty my corpse hath left, t'increase of dead the number numberless.
Great plan. Clearly no drawbacks here. Off you go, see how he takes it.
Go then. And if as yet he me bewail, if yet for me his heart one sigh forth breathe, blessed shall I be, and far with more content depart this world where so I me torment. Mean season us let this sad tomb enclose, attending here till death conclude our woes.
I will obey your will.
So the desert, the gods repay of thy true faithful heart.
And exeunt all save Diomed, who, let's face it, isn't going to present us with the most progressive of viewpoints. We might be minded to give him a pass, as this is a very stressful environment, and he doesn't want to die. And also, within the framework of the logic of not just an early modern text, but also classical figures, this is representing the kind of thought processes that people at the time would have had. I think Diomedes' point of view would have been considered quite reasonable. We, of course, can view it from a modern perspective and disagree, but it is a reasonable character point for him to make this argument that he is going to make, which we will now discuss. Anyway, he starts with themes from the start of the play. The themes of this play do keep interweaving in slightly different forms. It is structurally very, very tight, actually, depending, of course, on how much of these kind of debates you're into. So, returning to themes from earlier, how does love end up creating such horrors? The early modern mind, and certainly if you look at lots of plays featuring Cupid, has a real distrust of love. It's dangerous. It's not some, lovely, soft, squishy thing. It's something really chaotic and dangerous and distrustworthy, and the excess of it. So how does love create such horrors? Surely Cleopatra's beauty can still stem the tide and make all well again.
And is't not pity, gods, our gods of heaven, to see from love such hateful fruits to spring? And is't not pity that this firebrand so lays waste the trophies of Philippi fields? Where are those sweet allurements, those sweet looks, which gods themselves right heart sick would have made? What doth that beauty, rarest gift of heaven, wonder of earth? Alas, what do those eyes and that sweet voice all Asia understood and sunburnt Afric wide in deserts spread? Is their force dead? Have they no further power? Cannot by them Octavius be surprised? Alas, Jove, in midst of all his ire, with thunderbolt in hand, some land to plague, had cast his eyes on my queen, out of hand, his plaguing bolt had fallen out of his hand. Fire out of his wrath into vain smoke should turn, and other fire within his breast should burn.
And now he really goes off on one about how beautiful Cleopatra is, or, more importantly, was. Again, this has a colour bias mixed into it, with the alabaster skin, again, a beauty bias from white as against to black.
Not live so fair. Nature, by such a work herself should seem in workmanship hath passed. She is all heavenly. Never any man but seeing her was ravished with her sight. The alablaster covering of her face, the coral colour her two lips ingrains, her beamy eyes, two suns of this our world, of her fair hair the fine and flaming gold, her brave straight stature and her winning parts are nothing else but fires, fetters, darts.
And it ain't just that she's got a pretty face, too. I mean, oh, no. Cleopatra, she's got skills, too. She is a genuine people personality.
Yet this is nothing to the enchanting skills of her celestial spirit. Her training speech, her grace, her majesty, and forcing voice. Whither she it with fingers, speech, consort, or hearing sceptred king's ambassadors answer to each in his own language make.
Except, and this is something, again, that comes direct from sources, she's a bit of a hot mess right now, so we shouldn't hold out too much hope from her allurements saving the day. Boy, yeah, it doesn't come off well, does Diomed?
Yet now, at need, it aids her not at all, with all these beauties so her sorrow stings. Darkened with woe, her only study is to weep, to sigh, to seek for loneliness. Careless of all, her hair disordered hangs. Her charming eyes, whence murthering looks did fly, now rivers grown, whose wellspring anguish is, do trickling wash the marble of her face. Her fair discovered breast, with sobbing swollen, self-cruel she still martyreth with blows.
To be a little too flippant, please, for the sake of all our lives, Cleopatra, put on some makeup.
Alas, it's our ill hap, for if her tears she would convert into her loving charms to make a conquest of the conqueror, as well she might would she her force employ, she should us safety from these ills procure, her crown to her, and to her race assure. Unhappy he in whom self-succour lies, yet self-forsaken, wanting succour, dies.
Exit the patriarchy. Exit Diomed. Here we are left with the chorus. And this time there is no doubt as to this being an end-of-act chorus, here to play with the themes of the act and the preceding scene. Again, for our recording, I decided to go for a choric effect of multiple voices, only two or three, and it might be more in the final mix. I think this was a terrible idea, but I also think this particular chorus for this play needs a less naturalistic sound. It's very short line verse, it's very choppy, it's doing strange things, and I'm probably horribly wrong about that. But anyway, this is what you've got. In this case, the chorus is going to talk about Egypt and Rome, the two opposing forces in this play, via the medium of their respective rivers, the Nile of Egypt and Tiber of Rome. The Nile, first up, is a fertile river that floods and brings great bounty.
Oh, sweet, fertile land, wherein Phoebus did with breath inspire, man who men did first begin, formed first of Nile's mire, whence Avartes, the eldest kinds, earth's most heavenly ornament, were as from their fountain sent to enlight our misty minds, whose gross sprite from endless time, as in darkened prison pent, never did to knowledge climb. Where the Nile, our father good, father-like doth never miss, yearly us to bring such food as to life required is. Visiting each year this plain, and with fat slime covering it, which his seven mouths do spit as the season comes again, making thereby greatest grow, busy reapers' joyful pain, when his floods do highest flow.
The Nile is like, it's just so great. Now for the less impressive Tiber, with her prideful children who will oppress the wonderful Nile.
Wandering prince of rivers thou, honour of the Ethiop's land, of a lord and master now, thou as slave in awe must stand. Now of Tiber, which is spread, less in force and less in fame, reverence thou must the name, whom all other rivers dread, for his children swollen in pride, who by conquest seek to tread round this earth on every side.
Now, rather than just bringing in bounty, the river will be used to take Egypt's riches away from her, thanks to Rome.
Now thou must begin to send tribute of thy watery store, as sea paths thy steps shall bend, yearly presents more and more. Thy fat scum, our fruitful corn, piled from hence with thievish hands, all unclothed shall leave our lands, into foreign country borne, which puffed up with such a prey, shall thereby the praise adorn of that sceptre Rome doth sway.
There are a couple of verses now on the meandering river, how lovely it is, I think. I have struggled slightly to pass what's going on there.
Nought thee helps thy horns to hide, far from hence in unknown grounds. They thy waters wander wide, yearly breaking banks and bounds. And that thy sky-coloured brooks through 100 people pass, drawing plots for trees and grass, with 1,000 turns and crooks, whom all weary of their way, thy throats which in wideness pass, power into their mother sea. Nought so happy, hapless life, in this world as freedom finds, nought wherein more sparks are rife to inflame courageous minds. But if force must us enforce, needs a yoke to undergo, under foreign yoke to go, still it proves a bondage worse, and doubled subjection. See we shall, and feel, and know, subject to a stranger grown.
But now all this loveliness is under the yoke of Rome. Boo, hiss!
From henceforward for a king, whose first being from this place should his breast by nature bring, care of country to embrace, we at surly face must quake of some Roman madly bent, who our terror to augment, his proconsul's axe will shake, driving with our kings from hence our established government, justice sword and law's defence.
But all these terrible things, what's she going to do? I mean, it's destiny, am I right?
Nothing worldly of such might, but more mighty destiny, by swift time's unbridled flight, makes in end his end to see. Everything time o'erthrows, nor to end doth steadfast stay. His great scythe mows all the way, as the stalk of tender rose. Only immortality of the heavens doth it oppose, 'gainst his powerful deity.
But however badly destiny is kicking the Nile's arse right now, remember, karma is a bitch, and the chorus goes all predicty. There will come a time when Rome too will fall.
One day there will come a day which shall quail thy fortune's flower, and thee ruined low shall lay in some barbarous prince's power, when the pity-wanting fire shall, O Rome, thy beauties burn, and to humble ashes turn thy proud wealth and rich attire, those gilt roofs which turret-wise justly making envy mourn, threaten now to pierce skies.
You reap what you sow, Romans.
As thy forces fill each land, harvest making here and there, reaping all with ravening hand, they find growing anywhere. From each land, so to thy fall, multitudes repairs shall make, from the common spoil to take, what to each man's share may fall. Fingered all thou shalt behold, no jot left for token's sake, that thou wert so great of old.
And because this is a neoclassical tragedy, everything has to be wrapped up with a reference to how it's all like Troy.
Like unto the ancient Troy, whence derived thy founders be, conquering foe shall thee enjoy, and a burning prey in thee. For within this turning ball, this we see, and see each day, all things fixed ends do stay, ends to first beginnings fall. And that naught, how strong or strange, changeless doth endure alway, but endureth fatal change.
And mic drop, chorus, close to Act Two, and that's your lot. I actually quite like this chorus. I am, listeners, regular listeners to the podcast and viewers of our YouTube channel will know I am not the biggest fan of choruses, but I do quite like what the chorus is trying to do. This particular one works quite nicely. I like all the Nile Tiber stuff. I like the experimentation of verse that is something that is played with by both authors here, both the original and in translation, to give them something different to the verse of the rest of the play, and I do appreciate that. So yeah, I'm more of a fan of the chorus than sometimes I have been. And despite the many issues with the politics of the portrayal of Cleopatra in this play, this scene does give us something to chew on. Yes, Cleopatra is very extreme, but so was Antony. I mean, they are both in the absolute depths of despair. They are both talking about love. They are both clearly obsessed with each other. They are believing bad things about each other. But there is something very genuine about their relationship here. You know, this is a genuine love story that has just gone horribly, horribly wrong. But the scene does give a dynamic between her servants and herself as they're playing with the ideas of what to do in a situation like this, how to end one's life, what to do with the people around you, your children, your lover, your servants, the people, and the emotions that come in with it. And that pivot line towards the end when Charmian says, well, of course we're staying with you and we're going to die with you at the bitter end. Of course we're going to do that. How could you not think we were going to do that? I do find that very satisfying. And so there is something to play here, and I'm always interested in what you can give actors something they can do something with. And even Diomed's speech said earlier, exit the patriarchy, and yes. But also from his point of view, it's a perfectly reasonable argument. You know, she has to a degree got everyone into this mess, and her allurements got them there, and maybe her allurements could get them out. Again, as I say, the patriarchy is landing head first onto that. But from his character point of view, there is something to play there. And it's something that the production may need to play with to make sure that the audience knows where the play is coming from, where history is coming from, where we as a modern audience are coming from. Whether we succeed or not in our version, we shall see. There are many thoughts and plans for the future. But that's it for Act Two, for better or worse. The structure of the play is now much more straightforward, so you can relax a bit. I'm not going to be talking about reorganising scenes and where does Act One and Act Two begin and end. It's all very schematic from this point onwards. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the text, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, I think I have several disagreements with my thoughts, but hey, or if I'm in plain, demonstrable error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your thoughts, or not. Life's sometimes too short. And that's it from this spoiler episode. In a moment, there will be a plain text recording of the scenes featured. And there are a host, far too many, frankly, of exploring sessions on the podcast and on our YouTube, and links to material for the play as well in the show description. But till then, I've been your host, Robert Crichton, and I leave you with the plain text edit of The Tragedy of Antony, close of Act Two, with Pamela Flanagan as Cleopatra, Sarah Golding as Eris, Lee MacDonald as Charmian, Geir Madeland as Diomed, Robert Crichton and Gillian Horgan as voices in the chorus. Enjoy.
That I have thee betrayed, dear Antony. My life, my soul, my son. I had such thought. That I have thee betrayed, my lord, my king. That I would break my vowed faith to thee, leave thee, deceive thee, yield thee to the rage of mighty foe. I ever had that heart. Rather sharp lightning lighten on my head. Rather may I to deepest mischief fall. Rather the opened earth devour me. Rather fierce tigers feed them on my flesh. Rather, oh, rather let Arnila send to swallow me quick some weeping crocodile. And didst thou then suppose my royal heart had hatched thee to ensnare a faithless love? And changing mind, as fortune changed cheer, I would weak thee, to win the stronger lose. O wretch! O caitiff! O too cruel hap! And did not I sufficient loss sustain, losing my realm, losing my liberty, my tender offspring, and the joyful light of beamy sun? And yet losing more, thee, Antony, my care, if I lose not what yet remained. Thy love, alas, thy love more dear than sceptre, children, freedom, light. So ready I to row in Charon's barge shall lease the joy of dying in thy love. So the sole comfort of my misery to have one tomb with thee is me bereft. So I in shady plains shall plain alone, not as I hoped, companion of thy moan. O height of grief!
Why? With continual cries your griefful harms do you exasperate. Torment yourself with murdering complaints. Strain your weak breast so oft, so vehemently. Water with tears this fair alabaster. With sorrow sting so many beauties wound. Come, of so many kings, want you the heart bravely, stoutly, this tempest to resist?
My evils are wholly unsupportable. No human force can them withstand but death.
Oh, to him that strives, naught is impossible.
In striving lies no hope of my mishaps.
All things do yield to force of lovely face.
My face, too lovely, caused my wretched case. My face hath so entrapped, so cast us down, that for his conquest Caesar may it thank, causing that Antony one army lost, the other wholly did to Caesar yield. For not enduring so his amorous sprite was with my beauty fired, my shameful flight, soon as he saw from rank wherein he stood in hottest fight, my galleys making sail, forgetful of his charge, as if his soul unto his lady's soul had been enchained, he left his men, who so courageously did leave their lives to gain him victory. And careless both of fame and army's loss, my oared galleys followed with his ships, companion of my flight, by this base part blasting his former flourishing renown.
Are you therefore cause of his overthrow?
I am sole cause. I did it, only I.
Fear of a woman troubled so his sprite.
Fire of his love was by my fear inflamed.
And should he then to war have led a queen?
Alas, this was not his offence, but mine. Antony, ay me, who else so brave a chief? Would not I should have taken seas with him, but would have left me, fearful woman, far from common hazard of the doubtful war. Oh, that I had believed! Now, Now of Rome, all the great empire at our beck should bend. All should obey. The vagabonding scythes, the feared Germans, backshooting Parthians, wandering Numidians, Britons far removed, and tawny nations scorched with the sun. But I cared not. So was my soul possessed to my great harm with burning jealousy, fearing lest in my absence Antony should, leaving me, retake Octavia.
Such was the rigour of your destiny.
Such was my error and obstinacy.
But since God's would not, could you do with all?
Always from God's good haps, not harms, do fall.
And have they not all power on men's affairs?
They never bow so low as worldly cares, but leave to mortal men to be disposed freely on earth whatever mortal is. If we therein sometimes some faults commit, we may them not to their high majesties, but to ourselves impute, whose passions plunge us each day in all afflictions. Wherewith, when we our souls do thorned feel, flattering ourselves, we say they destinies are, that gods would have it so, that our care could not impeach, but that it must be so.
Things here below are in the heavens begot before they be in this our world born. And never can our weakness turn awry the sailless course of powerful destiny. Naught here, force, reason, human providence, holy devotion, noble blood, prevails. And Jove himself, whose hand doth heavens rule, who both to gods and men as king commands, who earth, our firm support, with plenty stores, moves air and sea with twinkling of his eye, who all can do, yet never can undo what once hath been by their hard laws decreed. When Trojan walls, great Neptune's workmanship, environed were with Greeks, and fortune's wheel, doubtful 10 years, now to the camp did turn, and now again towards the town returned. How many times did force and fury swell in Hector's veins, egging him to the spoil of conquered foes, which at his blows did fly as fearful sheep at feared wolves' approach, to save, in vain, for why, it would not be, poor walls of Troy from adversaries' rage, who dyed them in blood and cast to ground, heaped them with bloody burning carcasses. No, madam, think that if the ancient crown of your progenitors that Nilus ruled force take from you, the gods have willed it so, to whom oft-times princes are odious. They have to everything an end ordained. All worldly greatness by them bounded is, some sooner, later some, as they think best. None their decree is able to infringe. But, which is more, to us disastered men, which subject are in all things to their will is hid. Nor while we live, we know how or how long we must in life remain. Yet must we not for that feed on despair, and make us wretched ere we wretched be, but always hope the best, even to the last, that from ourselves the mischief may not grow. Then, madam, help yourself. Leave off in time Antony's rack, lest it your rack procure. Retire you from him, save from wrathful rage of angry Caesar both your realm and you. You see him lost, so as your amity unto his evils can yield no more relief. You see him ruined, so as your support no more henceforth can him with comfort raise. Withdraw you from the storm! Persist not still to lose yourself, this royal diadem, regain of Caesar.
Sooner shining light shall leave the day and darkness leave the night. Sooner moist currents of tempestuous seas shall wave in heaven, and the nightly troops of stars shall shine within the foaming waves, than I thee, Antony, leave in deep distress. I am with thee. Be it thy worthy soul lodge in thy breast, or from that lodging part crossing the joyless lake to take her place, in place prepared for men or demigods. live if thee please. If life be loathsome, die. Dead and alive, Antony, thou shalt see thy princess follow thee. Follow and lament thy wrack no less her own than was thy weal.
What helps his wrack this everlasting love?
Help or help not, such must, such ought I prove.
Ill done to lose yourself and to no end.
How ill think you to follow such a friend?
But this your love not mitigates his pain.
Without this love I should be inhumane.
Inhumane he who his own death pursues.
Not inhumane who misery eschews.
Live for your sons.
Nay, for their father die.
Hard-hearted mother.
Wife kind-hearted I.
Then will you them deprive of royal right?
Do I deprive them? No, it's destiny's might.
Do you not them deprive of heritage? That give them up to adversaries' hands, a man forsaken, fearing to forsake, whom such huge numbers hold environed? To abandon one against whom the frowning world, banded with Caesar, makes conspiring war.
The less ought I to leave him least of all. A friend in most distress should most assist. If that when Antony, great and glorious, his legions led to drink Euphrates' streams, so many kings in train redoubting him, in triumph raised as high as highest heaven, lordlike disposing as him pleased best, the wealth of Greece, the wealth of Asia, in that fair fortune had I him exchanged for Caesar, then men would have counted me faithless, unconstant, light. But now the storm and blustering tempest driving on his face ready to drown, alas, what would they say? What would himself in Pluto's mansion say, if I, whom always more than life he loved, if I, who am his heart, who was his hope, leave him, forsake him, and perhaps in vain, weakly to please who him hath overthrown? Not liked, unconstant, faithless should I be, but vile, forsworn of treacherous cruelty.
Cruelty to shun you self-cruel are.
Self-cruel him from cruelty to spare.
Our first affection to ourself is due.
He is myself.
Next it extends unto our children, friends, and to our country soil. And you, for some respect of wifely love, albeit scarce wifely, lose your native land, your children, friends, and which is more, your life. With so strong charms doth love bewitch our wits, so fast in us this fire once kindled flames. Yet if his harm by yours redress might have...
With mine it may be closed in darksome grave.
And that, as Alceste to herself unkind, you might exempt him from the laws of death. But he is sure to die. And now his sword, already moisted, is in his warm blood, helpless for any succour you can bring against death's sting, which he must shortly feel. Then let your love be like the love of old, which Carian Queen did nourish in her heart of her Morsellus. Build for him a tomb whose stateliness a wonder new may make. Let him have sumptuous funerals. Let grave thereon the horror of his fights. Let earth be buried with unburied heaps. Frame the farsely and discoloured streams of deep Enipeus. Frame the grassy plain which lodged his camp at siege of Mutina. Make all his combats and courageous acts and yearly plays to his praise institute. Honour his memory. With doubled care, breed and bring up the children of you both in Caesar's grace, who as a noble prince will leave them lords of this most glorious realm.
What shame were that? Ah, gods, what infamy! With Antony in his good haps to share, and o'erlive him dead, deeming enough to shed some tears upon a widow tomb. The afterlivers justly might report that I him only for his empire loved, and high estate, and that in hard estate I for another did him lewdly leave. Like to those birds wafted with wandering wings, from foreign lands in springtime here arrive, and live with us so long as summer's heat and their food lasts, then seek another soil. And, as we see with ceaseless fluttering flocking of sealy flies, a brownish cloud to vintaged wine yet working in the tun, not parting thence while they sweet liquor taste, after, as smoke, all vanish in the air, and of the swarm not one so much appear.
By this sharp death, what profit can you win?
I neither gain nor profit seek therein.
What praise shall you of after ages get?
Nor praise nor glory in my cares are set.
What other end ought you respect than this?
My only end, my only duty is.
Your duty must upon some good be founded.
On virtue it, the only good, is grounded.
What is that virtue?
That which us beseems.
Outrage ourselves, who that beseeming deems.
Finish I will my sorrows, dying thus.
Minish you will your glories doing thus.
Good friends, I pray you seek not to revoke my fixed intent of following Antony. I will die. I will die. Must not his life and death by mine be followed? Meanwhile, dear sisters, live, and while you live, do often honour to our loved tombs. Strew them with flowers, and sometimes, haply, the tender thought of Antony, your lord, and me, poor soul, to tears shall you invite, and our true loves your doleful voice commend.
And think you, madam, we from you will part? Think you alone to feel death's ugly dart? Think you to leave us? And that the same sun shall see at once you dead and us alive? We'll die with you. And Clotho pitiless shall us with you in hellish boat embark.
Ah, live, I pray you. This disastered woe which racks my heart alone to me belongs. My lot longs not to you, servants to be no shame, no harm to you as is to me. Live, sisters, live! And seeing his suspect hath causeless me in sea of sorrows drowned, and that I cannot live, if so I would, nor yet would leave this life, if so I could, without his love. Procure me, Diomed, that against poor me he be no more incensed. Rest out of his conceit that harmful doubt that since his wrack he hath of me conceived, though wrong conceived, witness you reverent gods, barking Anubis, Apis bellowing. Tell him, my soul burning, impatient, forlorn with love of him, for certain seal of her true loyalty my corpse hath left, to increase of dead the number numberless. Go then, and if as yet he me bewail, if yet for me his heart one sigh forth breathe, blessed shall I be, and far with more content depart this world where so I me torment. Mean season us let this sad tomb enclose, attending here till death conclude our woes.
I will obey your will.
So the desert, the gods repay of thy true faithful heart.
And is't not pity, gods, our gods of heaven, to see from love such hateful fruits to spring? And is't not pity that this firebrand so lays waste the trophies of Philippi fields? Where are those sweet allurements, those sweet looks, which gods themselves right heart sick would have made? What doth that beauty, rarest gift of heaven, wonder of earth? Alas, what do those eyes, and that sweet voice all Asia understood, and sunburnt Afric wide in deserts spread? Is their force dead? Have they no further power? Cannot by them Octavius be surprised? Alas, if Jove in midst of all his ire, with thunderbolt in hand some land to plague, had cast his eyes on my queen, out of hand, his plaguing bolt had fallen out of his hand, fire out of his wrath into vain smoke should turn, and other fire within his breast should burn. Nought lives so fair. Nature, by such a work herself should seem in workmanship hath passed. She is all heavenly. Never any man, but seeing her, was ravished with her sight. The alabaster covering of her face, the coral colour her two lips ingrains, her beamy eyes, two suns of this our world, of her fair hair the fine and flaming gold, her brave straight stature, and her winning parts, are nothing else but fires, fetters, darts. Yet this is nothing to the enchanting skills of her celestial spirit, her training speech, her grace, her majesty, and forcing voice. Whither she it with fingers, speech, consort, or hearing sceptred king's ambassadors answer to each in his own language make. Yet now, at need, it aids her not at all, with all these beauties so her sorrow stings. Darkened with woe, her only study is to weep, to sigh, to seek for loneliness. Careless of all, her hair disordered hangs. Her charming eyes, whence murthering looks did fly, now rivers grown, whose wellspring anguish is, do trickling wash the marble of her face. Her fair discovered breast, with sobbing swollen, self-cruel she still martyreth with blows. Alas! It's our ill-hap, for if her tears she would convert into her loving charms to make a conquest of the conqueror, as well she might would she her force employ, she should us safety from these ills procure, her crown to her, and to her race assure. Unhappy he in whom self-succour lies, yet self-forsaken, wanting succour, dies.
O sweet, fertile land, wherein Phoebus did with breath inspire, man who men did first begin, formed first of Nile's mire, when Cervates, the eldest kinds, earth's most heavenly ornament, were as from their fountain sent to enlight our misty minds, whose gross sprite from endless time, as in darkened prison pent, never did to knowledge climb. Where the Nile, our father good, father-like doth never miss, yearly us to bring such food as to life required is. Visiting each year this plain, and with fat slime covering it, which his seven mouths do spit as the season comes again, making thereby greatest grow, busy reapers' joyful pain, when his floods do highest flow. Wandering prince of rivers thou, honour of the Ethiops' land, of a lord and master now, thou as slave in awe must stand. Now of Tiber, which is spread, less in force and less in fame, reverence thou must the name, whom all other rivers dread, for his children swollen in pride, who by conquest seek to tread round this earth on every side. Now thou must begin to send tribute of thy watery store, as sea paths thy steps shall bend, yearly presents more and more. Thy fat scum, our fruitful corn, piled from hence with thievish hands, all unclothed shall leave our lands into foreign country born, which puffed up with such a prey shall thereby the praise adorn of that sceptre Rome doth sway. Nought thee helps thy horns to hide far from hence in unknown grounds. They thy waters wander wide, yearly breaking banks and bounds, and that thy sky-coloured brooks, Through 100 people pass, drawing plots for trees and grass, with 1,000 turns and crooks, whom all weary of their way, thy throats which in wideness pass, power into their mother sea. Naught so happy, hapless life, in this world as freedom finds, naught wherein more sparks are rife, to inflame courageous minds. But if force must us enforce, needs a yoke to undergo, under foreign yoke to go, still it proves a bondage worse, and doubled subjection. See we shall, and feel, and know, subject to a stranger grown. From henceforward for a king, whose first being from this place should his breast by nature bring, care of country to embrace, we at surly face must quake, of some Roman madly bent, who our terror to augment, his proconsul's axe will shake, driving with our kings from hence, our established government, justice sword and law's defence. Nothing worldly of such might, but more mighty destiny, by swift time's unbridled flight, makes in end his end to see. Everything time o'erthrows, nor to end doth steadfast stay. His great scythe mows all the way, as the stalk of tender rose. Only immortality of the heavens doth it oppose, 'gainst his powerful deity. One day there will come a day which shall quail thy fortune's flower, and thee ruined low shall lay in some barbarous prince's power, when the pity-wanting fire shall, O Rome, thy beauties burn, and to humble ashes turn thy proud wealth and rich attire, those gilt roofs which turret-wise, justly making envy mourn, threaten now to pierce skies. As thy forces fill each land, harvest making here and there, reaping all with ravening hand, they find growing anywhere. From each land, so to thy fall, multitudes repairs shall make, from the common spoil to take, what to each man's share may fall. Fingered all thou shalt behold, no jot left for token's sake, that thou wert so great of old. Like unto the ancient Troy, whence derived thy founders be, conquering foe shall thee enjoy, and a burning prey in thee. For within this turning ball, this we see, and see each day, all things fixed ends do stay, ends to first beginnings fall, and that naught, how strong or strange, changeless doth endure alway, but endureth fatal change.
In the plain text edit of The Tragedy of Antony by Robert Carnier, translated by Mary Sidney, Pamela Flanagan was Cleopatra, Sarah Golding, Eris, Lee MacDonald, Charmian, Geir Madeland, Diomed, with Robert Crichton and Gillian Horgan as voices in the chorus. Spoilers is hosted and produced by Robert Crichton for the Beyond podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com or become a patron and get early access and bonus material? Our patrons get to choose the plays we work on next. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Links in the show description. Goodbye.